Chapter 26. And lances, the usual weapons of the country, and which they are very dexterous at the throwing, even so dexterous, that it was scarce credible. And had our men stood to fight them, as some of them were bold enough to talk of, they had been all overwhelmed and killed. As it was, 17 of our men were wounded, and some of them very dangerously. But they were more frighted than hurt too, for every one of them gave themselves over for dead men, believing the lances were poisoned. But William was our comfort here too. For, when two of our surgeons were of the same opinion, and told the men foolishly enough that they would die, William cheerfully went to work with them, and cured them all but one, who rather died by drinking some Eric punch than of his wound, the excess of drinking throwing him into a fever. We had enough of Ceylon, though some of our people were for going ashore again, 60 or 70 men together, to be revenged. But William persuaded them against it, and his reputation was so great among the men, as well as with us that were commanders, that he could influence them more than any of us. They were mighty warm upon their revenge, and they would go on shore and destroy 500 of them. Well, says William, and suppose you do, what are you the better? Why then, says one of them, speaking for the rest, we shall have our satisfaction. Well, and what will you be the better for that? Says William. They could then say nothing to that. Then, says William, if I mistake not, your business is money. Now, I desire to know, if you conquer, and kill 2 or 3,000 of these poor creatures, they have no money, pray what will you get? They are poor naked wretches, what shall you gain by them? But then, says William, perhaps, in doing this, you may chance to lose half a score of your own company, as it is very probable you may. Pray, what gain is in it? And what account can you give the captain for his lost men? In short, William argued so effectually, that he convinced them that it was mere murder to do so, and that the men had a right to their own, and that they had no right to take them away, that it was destroying innocent men, who had acted no otherwise than as the laws of nature dictated, and that it would be as much murder to do so, as to meet a man on the highway, and kill him, for the mere sake of it, in cold blood, not regarding whether he had done any wrong to us or no. These reasons prevailed with them at last, and they were content to go away, and leave them as they found them. In the first skirmish they killed between 60 and 70 men, and wounded a great many more, but they had nothing, and our people got nothing by it, but the loss of one man's life, and the wounding 16 more, as above. But another accident brought us to a necessity of further business with these people, and indeed we had like to have put an end to our lives and adventures all at once among them. For, about 3 days after our putting out to sea from the place where we had that skirmish, we were attacked by a violent storm of wind from the south, or rather a hurricane of wind from all the points southward, for it blew in a most desperate and furious manner from the SE to the S. W, 1 minute at one point, and then instantly turning about again to another point, but with the same violence. Nor were we able to work the ship in that condition, so that the ship I was in split 3 top sails, and at last, brought the main top mast by the board. And, in a word, we were once or twice driven right ashore, and one time, had not the wind shifted the very moment it did, we had been dashed in 1,000 pieces upon a great ledge of rocks which lay off about half a league from the shore. But, as I have said, the wind shifting very often, and at that time coming to the ESE, we stretched off, and got above a league more sea room in half an hour. After that, it blew with some fury SW by S, then S. W by W, and put us back again a great way to the eastward of the ledge of rocks, where we found a great opening between the rocks and the land, and endeavored to come to an anchor there, but we found there was no ground fit to anchor in, and that we should lose our anchors, there being nothing but rocks. We stood through the opening, which held about 4 leagues. The storm continued, and now we found a dreadful foul shore, and knew not what course to take. We looked out very narrowly for some river or creek or bay, where we might run in, and come to an anchor, but found none a great while. At length we saw a great headland lie out far south into the sea, and that to such a length, that, in short, we saw plainly that, if the wind held where it was, we could not weather it, so we ran in as much under the lee of the point as we could, and came to an anchor in about 12 fathom water. But the wind veering again in the night, and blowing exceedingly hard, our anchors came home, and the ship drove till the rudder struck against the ground. And had the ship gone half her length farther, she had been lost, and every one of us with her. But our sheet anchor held its own, and we heaved in some of the cable, to get clear of the ground we had struck upon. It was by this only cable that we rowed it out all night, and towards morning we thought the wind abated a little, and it was well for us that it was so, for, in spite of what our sheet anchor did for us, we found the ship fast aground in the morning, to our very great surprise and amazement. When the tide was out, though the water here ebbed away, the ship lay almost dry upon a bank of hard sand, which never, I suppose, had any ship upon it before. The people of the country came down in great numbers, to look at us and gaze, not knowing what we were, but gaping at us, as at a great sight or wonder at which they were surprised, and knew not what to do. I have reason to believe that upon the sight they immediately sent an account of a ship being there, and of the condition we were in, for the next day there appeared a great man, whether it was their king, or no I know not, but he had abundance of men with him, and some with long javelins in their hands, as long as half pikes, and these came all down to the water's edge, and drew up in a very good order, just in our view. They stood near an hour without making any motion, and then there came near 20 of them, with a man before them carrying a white flag. They came forward into the water as high as their waists, the sea not going so high as before, for the wind was abated, and blew off the shore. The man made a long oration to us, as we could see by his gestures, and we sometimes heard his voice, but knew not one word he said. William, who was always useful to us, I believe was here again the saving of all our lives. The case was this. The fellow, or what I might call him, when his speech was done, gave 3 great screams, for I know not what else to say they were, then lowered his white flag 3 times, and then made 3 motions to us with his arm to come to him. I acknowledge that I was for manning out the boat and going to them, but William would by no means allow me. He told me we ought to trust nobody, that, if they were barbarians, and under their own government, we might be sure to be all murdered, and, if they were Christians, we should not fare much better, if they knew who we were, that it was the custom of the Malabars to betray all people that they could get into their hands, and that these were some of the same people, and that, if we had any regard to our own safety, we should not go to them by any means. I opposed him a great while, and told him I thought he used to be always right, but that now I thought he was not, that I was no more for running needless risks than he or anyone else, but I thought all nations in the world, even the most savage people, when they held out a flag of peace, kept the offer of peace made by that signal very sacredly, and I gave him several examples of it in the history of my African travels, which I have here gone through in the beginning of this work, and that I could not think these people worse than some of them. And, besides, I told him our case seemed to be such, that we must fall into somebody's hands or other, and that we had better fall into their hands by a friendly treaty than by a forced submission, nay, though they had indeed a treacherous design, and therefore I was for a parley with them. Well, friend, says William very gravely, if thou wilt go I cannot help it. I shall only desire to take my last leave of thee at parting, for, depend upon it, thou wilt never see us again. Whether we in the ship may come off any better at last I cannot resolve thee, but this I will answer for, that we will not give up our lives idly, and in cool blood, as thou art going to do. We will at least preserve ourselves, as long as we can, and die at last like men, not like fools, trepanned by the wiles of a few barbarians. William spoke this with so much warmth, and yet with so much assurance of our fate, that I began to think a little of the risk I was going to run. I had no more mind to be murdered than he, and yet I could not for my life be so faint-hearted in the thing as he. Upon which I asked him if he had any knowledge of the place, or had ever been there. He said, no. Then I asked him if he had heard or read anything about the people of this island, and of their way of treating any Christians that had fallen into their hands, and he told me he had heard of one, and he would tell me the story afterward. His name, he said, was Knox, commander of an East India ship, who was driven on shore, just as we were, upon this island of Ceylon, though he could not say it was at the same place, or whereabouts. That he was beguiled by the barbarians, and enticed to come on shore, just as we were invited to do at that time, and that, when they had him, they surrounded him, and 18 or 20 of his men, and never suffered them to return, but kept them prisoners, or murdered them, he could not tell which, but they were carried away up into the country, separated from one another, and never heard of afterwards, except the captain's son, who miraculously made his escape, after 20 years' slavery. I had no time then, to ask him to give the full story of this Knox, much less to hear him tell it me, but, as it is usual in such cases, when one begins to be a little touched, I turned short with him. Why then, friend William, said I, what would you have us do? You see what condition we are in, and what is before us. Something must be done, and that immediately. Why, says William, I'll tell thee what thou shalt do. First, cause a white flag to be hanged out, as they do to us, and man out the longboat and pinnace with as many men as they can well stow, to handle their arms, and let me go with them, and thou shalt see what we will do. If I miscarry, thou mayest be safe. And I will also tell thee, that if I do miscarry, it shall be my own fault, and thou shalt learn wit by my folly. I knew not what to reply to him at first, but, after some pause, I said, William, William, I am as both you should be lost as you are that I should, and if there be any danger, I desire you may no more fall into it than one. Therefore, if you will, let us all keep in the ship, fair like, and take our fate together. No, no, says William, there's no danger in the method I propose. Thou shalt go with me, if thou thinkest fit. If thou pleasest, but to follow the measures that I shall resolve on, depend upon it, though we will go off from the ships, we will not a man of us go any nearer them than within call to talk with them. Thou seest they have no boats to come off to us. But, says he, I rather desire thou wouldst take my advice, and manage the ships as I shall give the signal from the boat, and let us concert that matter together, before we go off. Well, I found William had his measures in his head all laid beforehand, and was not at a loss what to do at all, so I told him he should be captain for this voyage, and we would be all of us under his orders, which I would see observed to a tittle. Upon this conclusion of our debates, he ordered 24 men into the long boat, and 12 men into the pinnace, and the sea being now pretty smooth, they went off, being all very well armed. Also he ordered that all the guns of the great ship, on the side which lay next the shore, should be loaded with musket balls, old nails, stubs, and such like pieces of old iron, lead, and anything that came to hand. And that we should prepare to fire, as soon as ever we saw them lower the white flag and hoist up a red one in the pinnace. With these measures fixed between us, they went off towards the shore, William in the pinnace with 12 men, and the longboat coming after him with 24 more, all stout resolute fellows, and very well armed. They rowed so near the shore as that they might speak to one another, carrying a white flag, as the other did, and offering a parley. The brutes, for such they were, showed themselves very courteous, but finding we could not understand them, they fetched an old Dutchman, who had been their prisoner many years, and set him to speak to us. The sum and substance of his speech was that the king of the country had sent his general down to know who we were and what our business was. William stood up in the stern of the pinnace and told him that as to that, he, that was an European, by his language and voice, might easily know what we were and our condition. The ship being aground upon the sand would also tell him that our business there was that of a ship in distress. So William desired to know what they came down for with such a multitude, and with arms and weapons, as if they came to war with us. He answered, they might have good reason to come down to the shore, the country being alarmed with the appearance of ships of strangers upon the coast, and as our vessels were full of men, and as we had guns and weapons, the king had sent part of his military men, that, in case of any invasion upon the country, they might be ready to defend themselves, whatsoever might be the occasion. But, says he, as you are men in distress, the king has ordered his general, who is here also, to give you all the assistance he can, and to invite you on shore, and receive you with all possible courtesy. Says William, very quick upon him, before I give thee an answer to that, I desire thee to tell me what thou art, for by thy speech thou art an European. He answered presently, he was a Dutchman. That I know well, says William, by thy speech. But art thou a native Dutchman of Holland, or a native of this country, that has learned Dutch, by conversing among the Hollanders, who we know, are settled upon this island? No, says the old man, I am a native of Delft, in the province of Holland, in Europe. Well, says William, immediately, but art thou a Christian or a heathen, or what we call a renegado? I am, says he, a Christian. And so they went on, in a short dialogue, as follows. William, thou art a Dutchman, and a Christian, thou sayest, pray, art thou a freeman or a servant? Dutchman, I am a servant to the king here, and in his army. W, but art thou a volunteer, or a prisoner? D, indeed I was a prisoner at first, but am at liberty now, and so am a volunteer. W, that is to say, being first a prisoner, thou hast liberty to serve them, but art thou so at liberty that thou mayest go away, if thou pleasest, to thine own countrymen? D. No, I do not say so. My countrymen live a great way off, on the north and east parts of the island, and there is no going to them without the king's express license. W, well, and why dost thou not get a license to go away? D. I have never asked for it. W. And, I suppose, if thou didst, thou knowest thou couldst not obtain it. D. I cannot say much as to that, but why do you ask me all these questions? W. Why, my reason is good. If thou art a Christian and a prisoner, how canst thou consent to be made an instrument to these barbarians, to betray us into their hands? Who are thy countrymen and fellow Christians? Is it not a barbarous thing in thee to do so? D. How do I go about to betray you? Do I not give you an account how the king invites you to come on shore and has ordered you to be treated courteously and assisted? W. As thou art a Christian, though I doubt it much, dost thou believe the king or the general, as thou callest it, means one word of what he says? D. He promises you by the mouth of his great general. W. I don't ask thee what he promises, or by whom, but I ask thee this. Canst thou say that thou believest he intends to perform it? D. How can I answer that? How can I tell what he intends? W. Thou canst tell what thou believest. D. I cannot say, but he will perform it. I believe he may. W, thou art, but a double-tongued Christian, I doubt. Come, I'll ask thee another question. Wilt thou say, that thou believest it, and that thou wouldst advise me to believe it, and put our lives into their hands upon these promises? D. I am not to be your advisor. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.